Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Martin or kind of gone to his head a bit, and he's
his legs aperture.
And he's joined on stage by Danny Thompson, the famous who played with Tim Ripley, who played with John Martin.
Is Danny Thompson
Richard Thompson's brother? Is that
no? Although they played together,
they have played together.
No relation.
How amazing!
So anyway, they come on stage, and Riley Walker goes a massive round of applause.
Riley Walker is stoned off his box.
A massive round of applause for the two acts, and they come. Riley Walker points at the musician on stage, and he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, Danny fucking Thompson, right?" And someone in the audience goes, "Yeah, mate, we know who he is. Who the fuck are you?"
I forget you're that brilliant.
That is great. That's great. Oh, for a really good heckle, eh?
Yeah.
I've never felt I'd seen him twice, Roy, because I saw him first at Hoxton, was it Hoxton Bar or something?
Oh, great. And
I've never felt so in with the in crowd, because it was like all the music jerks. So Pete Perfidis is there with Caitlin, and you know everyone's standing around, there's like 150 people watching Riley Walker. And who was it? Pete Perfidis was going on and on about it the day after. I can't remember who else was there. But I thought, money. I'm in with the 40 something in crowd.
Riley Walker's playing Port Elliot.
Really?
Is he?
Yeah, he is.
Great.
Do you really like that stuff, though? Really? Yeah.
What? Richard Thompson?
But when you say that stuff...
John Martin.
What stuff are you referring
70s
to?
70s British fucking folk music.
It's not folk music.
Okay.
John Martin doesn't play folk music.
It's time for me to tell you something about Matthew.
Fucking folk music. What?
His parents are folk musicians. He was brought up in a home. That's the. He lives in Lewis.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that growing?
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry for your loss.
There was a great internet meme of a photo of a dog staring into a camera with two people playing guitars in the background. And someone had put a caption that said, "Save pets from folk museum, donate now." Because the dog's like this.
So, Matthew, you may not wish to reveal this if it's being recorded, but was your childhood being dragged round festivals and pubs? And
no, but the Morris were often in our garden. They were referred to as the Morris.
They'd just be there, referred to it as a side.
Is there a side of Morris in the garden?
And what part of the side?
They used to defecate in the garden.
So you've got the whole kind of Rottingdean...
He's basically...
Copper family.
Yeah.
I wish everyone you could see them.
So I went back to my parents a couple of weeks ago, and there, my mum's old friend Jerry was there. Jerry was there, and I was like, "Hi, Jerry, how are you? I haven't seen you for 30 years. And he was, in fact, the guy that started the folk night in Rottingdean at the Copper family. And he said there was a night there where... I can't remember. Anyway, there's about four of them there. McCarthy's, the Waterstones.
Yeah. Waterstones.
Like Waterstones. All in one place in this little. It's not Waterstones.
An opportunity for you to.
That's a different family. Yeah.
Performed an act of.
I have to say, musical terrorism. Writing the Ballad of Matthew Clayton. A disgruntled man passes through the folk scene of Sussex in the 1970s.
But did you God. Consciously. Grow up defining your musical tastes against all that stuff then?
I don't think it was as simple as that. It was just always around. It was my parents' music. My dad played the concertina. Yeah. My mum ran the local folk club, singers and players. She was very much a purist, so she only ever sung. She didn't like accompanied folk music. And in fact, when in the 90s, so I started going to...
Where did she stand on the Dylan is due?
that was, she wouldn't understand that at all. She wouldn't understand Dylan. In fact, in the 90s, I started recording in this Interflow studio, started doing like sort of house music in this recording studio in Brighton that Chris Hampshire did, and it was very druggy music. Chris Hampshire, very kind of hard, druggy music, early 90s. But my mum was getting old, so I thought, I'm going to record her before she, before she dies. And so I took her to Chris Hampshire's studio, and I got Chris to record her, and she sang like 20 songs, just like that, kind of remembered all the words straight away.
Amazing. And then you put Vanessa out.
Yeah.
Matthew White's techno on the train on the way home.
Yeah, totally screwed away.
I'm not kidding. It's brilliant. It's my favourite thing. On the train, that's the really nice detail. Is it just because you get completely absorbed in it? You don't have to.
Someone complained last week.
Really?
Well, you can't wait for your.
Complained about the noise.
You play it out loud, do you?
No, I don't. But it was like it was on the headphones. But they literally, someone was really embarrassing.
Matthew, I can't wait for your kids to rebel by playing the mandolin.
It'll skip a generation.
But I had a thing on the train last week where a woman looked over what I was doing. She's like, "Oh, are you using Reason?" Which is like the software program I use. And I said, "Oh yeah, do you use it?" And she's like, "Mine." She's in her 40s. She's like, "No, my son does. He's 16."
Always with dignity.
Yeah.
This is convivial already.
It's brilliant.
That's brilliant. Oh. Concertina.
Yeah,
I'm that's how can we spiral? How can we spiral out of allergy to folk music into?
Yeah, there's not a lot of music in the Ruby Sands.
What were those brilliant? They were still. It still makes me laugh a lot. The Vic and Bob.
Mulligan and Doe.
Yeah. Of course you remember.
That's my job.
Yes.
Right. Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Once more, we're gathered around the table in the Unbound offices, the slightly echoey Unbound offices, and apologies if you find the sound difficult. We're working on it with books and blankets. Unbound, of course, are the publishing website that bring authors and readers together to make great books, and I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher at Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today is writer and journalist Lloyd Shepherd. Hello, Lloyd.
Hello, hello.
Lloyd works in the genre-straddling field of historical stroke crime stroke supernatural fiction.
I do, yeah. That's quite good. Can I use that?
I just occurred to
me. Can I use that?
You can. And his fourth book, featuring the adventures of 19th century London River policeman Charles Horton, the detective and the devil, was published earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. And the book that Lloyd has chosen to talk about this week, or backlisted, is The Riddle of the Sands by Erskine Childers, first published in 1903. As well as being regarded by many as the first spy novel, it's also the basis of an Unbound project. I have to declare an interest here that Lloyd and his co-conspirator Tim Wright are currently seeking pledges for on our website. More of that anon, I'm sure.
Before we start, Lloyd, could you just tell our listener what...
Hello, Tim.
What have you brought with you to enhance the experience of discussing Riddle of the Sands?
Well, Tim and I have been talking about Riddle of the Sands on our own podcast for the last year, and one of the things we talk a lot about is booze and food, and one of the things I brought is Dorncott, which is a Frisian gin that's made in Norden, which is a town in just on the mainland off the East Frisian
Islands. It's on the Norden line, isn't it? Norden.
It's on the Norden line.
Norden features in the book.
It features a lot in the book. Yeah, this is made in Norden in East Frisia. You're supposed to drink it either neat or with... I've also brought some bitters.
You care to... I feel that we should immediately set about the business.
Should we try some?
So let's...
There's only three glasses and there's five people in the room.
I'm driving.
Well, Matthew's
already
on the rosé. Matthew's already on the rosé.
The non-folk approved rosé wine.
Not really.
Okay, that's probably rather large.
Actually, we should also say that amongst the many skills of Matt, our producer, is he's a notable bread baker, and what we have in front of us is, Matt, can you just...
It's a sweet rye bread with cardamom and honey in.
It's very, very crispy on the outside and very, very chewy on the inside.
On purpose.
We're looking to fill the slot that the BBC Recipes website is going to leave behind. So as well as talking about books on future backlisted, we'll also be a narrative of food that you could eat alongside them.
Cheers.
It's going to be horrible.
Now, this sort of should be an audio prompt. Now raise your gin at home. So before I put a piece of that to you, gosh,
hey,
gone on.
Good. This could all go a lot better than expected.
My goodness. So before I stick a piece of this very chewy bread into my mouth, John, what have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a very, very, very delicious book called Six Facets of Light by Anne Roe, published by Jonathan Cape, and I have to say it's as handsome a book as I've seen in a long time.
Why do people always use the word handsome to describe books?
I don't know, it just falls so neatly.
If you notice that, you look on Twitter, people are always saying, what a handsome cover.
Handsome volume.
Maybe it's a booky word, I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, because sort of, you know, curvaceous just doesn't seem right.
I've seen sexy. People talk about sexy covers.
Yeah.
No one ever talks about a pretty book.
It's very good. Really lovely paper, no show through, beautiful colour illustrations.
And that's Anne Roe.
Anne Roe, yeah, who is, she is senior editor at The Economist.
She's the obituaries editor at The Economist.
And the obituaries editor, that's right. And she's also, she was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize for her biography of Pontius Pilate. So I was slightly trepidatious because I know that she writes, I mean, she's a very intelligent writer on Christian themes. But actually what this is a kind of, it's an attempt really to look at light, not as a scientist, light being the great paradoxical substance, you know, both wave and particle. It's invisible, but, you know, without it, we couldn't see anything. So, but it's an attempt to explore in through painters, poets, and philosophers, what light is, and it's based really around her walking along the East Sussex coast, I mean, particularly between Eastbourne and Brighton. And that sounds very vague and rambling, and in a way, the book is a little bit like that.
Yeah.
But it's saved by the fact that she writes exquisitely well. And it's also, it's such a brilliant theme. You think about it, she writes obviously about how light hits grass, how light hits trees, how light hits spider webs. She talks, so it's on one level, it's an amazingly detailed, kind of the new natural history. It fits neatly into that category. But it also allows her to talk about, you know, religious experience, about, I mean, there is some physics in the book. There's a lot of mythology in the book. There are notebooks of painters. There's some wonderful stuff. The themes, the painters that come around again and again, Eric Revilius, Samuel Palmer,
Did you go to the Revilius exhibition that was down in Dulwich?
I did.
Last year. Wasn't that great?
Yeah, I mean,
really good.
It's one of those sort of artists who seems to get more relevant and better as time. I don't quite know why. There's something about that flatness and the quality of the colour. So it was a lovely reading experience.
It's very John Mitchinson.
It is very,
isn't it?
It's very
because you've covered stone and rain, and now you've moved to light.
Light. I'm so sorry. Can I read you just a little bit?
Gives
you an idea of just how well written it is and how interesting. I just think you know, sometimes it would be very easy for you to turn around at a book like this and say, "Yeah, it's all right," but actually, she really delivers. She really. I mean, it's made me want to go back. Thomas Traherne. Which I sort of, you know, glancing knowledge of a lot of poets, but you realise that the great theme of poetry, Dante, the great theme of poetry, particularly any kind of transcendent sort of, is light. That's the thing. Is it a metaphor? Is it a metaphor?
What's a metaphor?
Anyway, here we go. Even daylight may be a distraction. It commands the stage so busily and glaringly that nothing prevails against it. Take away light, and the unseen garden lilac suddenly drowns the world in scent, and the invisible sea breathes and purrs as loudly as a great cat stretching, and human instincts are sharpened like a reptile's, the whole skin alert to possible contacts in the dark with the unknown and the unimagined. But then light returns, doodling and dancing. Its artfulness is flame-like, and it was in this form that Revilius most enjoyed it. Fireworks, bonfires, wind-blown beams from lighthouses or cars, patches of bracken ablaze on a hillside, even the simple, friendly flare of a match. I wish I had seen it, was his reaction to any outbreak he missed. Have you looked up Lambent yet? He eagerly asked his lover, Diana Tully, in 1939. Perhaps having described her glowing skin that way. Here it is, a flame or light, playing on surface without burning it, with soft radiance, of eyes, sky, etc. Radiant, of wit, gently brilliant.
Hence, lambency, lambently. Latin, lambere, to lick. There you are.
Mm. Very good.
It's nice.
Does she? I think I asked you, does she write about Margate? Does she write about
Margate? No, she's very, very, very particularly written about her patch, yeah, and her manner. And it's, again, there's nice little bits of sort of autobiography about, you know, having her a notebook when she's younger that's open and writing things in it. And there are bits of her notebooks threaded through it. Like I say, it's one of those books that, if she wasn't as good a writer as she is and as interesting a writer as she is, it might just feel self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think it was Einstein says somewhere in the book, you know, no rascal has any idea what light is. You know, we've pondered it. It's one of the great mysteries of the universe. We probably never know. It's a sort of, it's the paradox.
I have to say, we should put this up somewhere. That is a terrific cover.
It's terrific, but the book itself, feel it's to the heft and that. It's just really well done, Jonathan Cape, for still making books that.
The patch that she writes about is my patch, mm-hmm, which I moved to a few years ago.
I'm going to take this home
and read it. I'm looking forward to it.
I think that the point she makes are pretty, you know, I think it's not going to interfere with your enjoyment. But she's particularly good on chalk. There's a wonderful bit where she says that rabbits digging in the chalk, it's like they're kicking up light. I mean, it's because that landscape is so reflective, and that, you know, the combination of the white of the land and the blue of the sky and the blue of the sea. But I think she's really good. It's rare to get somebody who writes as well about painting as they do about literature, but she manages it. And it's such a, like I say, it's such a neat way of tying these experiences together.
I really want to read it. Sounds fantastic.
Thanks, John. That went really well with my bread.
For sure.
The bread was Matt. Mm.
And now, Andy, with more gin. What have you been reading?
Okay,
or
so
watching?
I'll keep the reading bit relatively brief because there's something else I want to talk about. I did a Q&A last week with the author Joanne Harris, who wrote Chocolat and 14 or 15 other novels. Mm-hmm. And she's great. If you ever get the chance to go and see Joanne talk, she's wonderful, really inspiring person.
And one of the best writers on Twitter, the way she does her stories on Twitter, I think.
And really good. Yeah. Well, I asked her about Twitter. She's great. She's really unrepentantly positive about Twitter.
Which is nice, isn't
she
it?
She doesn't go, oh, trolls.
Oh, I used to love it.
No, she's great. She's very positive and very
What did Steve Fry point out? Once she used to sneak off for a midnight skinny dip. Now it's a public swimming pool that other people have pissed in. Well,
so I was talking to Joanne about her new novel, which is called Different Class. It's the third novel set in Maltby, the town of Maltby, and it's set in a school. It bounces backwards and forwards between two narrative voices. It's terrific, but I really recommend it.
It is, it's really good.
The thing about Joanne, which we talked about and which is really interesting, is I once went to an event, a Clive James thing, where he was talking to publishers and booksellers, and he chided booksellers and said, the problem with you lot is you don't just have a Clive James section in your shops. His point being that he was a difficult writer to categorise, and if people like his stuff...
No, I think the point being was that he really wants to climb James.
and that, Matt, yes. But Joanne is a really hard writer. Joanne Harris is a really difficult writer to categorise, isn't she, Lloyd? She writes like books set in France around
her last three books
shops,
have been a follow-up to Chocolat.
Yeah.
Pictures from Monsieur Curie. The Gospel of Loki...
Yeah,
based on the Norse
myths.
Which just came out of... I mean, I know she's written the Rune novels, which are... Yeah. And then Different Class, which is a... But I can sympathise with that. I mean, my first three books, when I went into Waterstones Piccadilly once, my first three books were in three different sections of Waterstones Piccadilly. That's genre straddling.
I mean, without this wanting to sound like a kind of cheap advert... but it is one of the reasons that we wanted to do Unbound. This classification thing is, to me, is a massive tail, you know, tiny tail wagging a very large dog, because you want writers. The whole point about writers, surely, is you want them to do different things.
Yeah. But don't you also think the readers, there's a reader expectation. So I've had complaints from historical fiction fans. They go, what's this weird stuff doing there? I've had complaints from weird fiction fans going, what's this historical stuff doing there? There is an expectation for people to book it. Some people want
Jonathan Meads, a great line of Jonathan Meads, which I want to quote, is that anything really good creates its own genre.
Yeah.
Well, Joanne, I said to Joanne, you know, do you ever give, you know, do you ever give, does it ever give you pause for thought that you ought not to dart around so much? You know, what is it, do you feel, that ties all your books together, given that they are disparate in their subjects? And she just said, it's me.
Yeah.
And if people want to read me, they'll find me.
And that she's got, you know, an amazing gift for narrative. And she's great. She's a really good storyteller.
Amazing gift for voice. I mean, the voice is the voice of the classics teacher in the new book, Different Classes, really reminded me of my Latin teacher from school. It's really strong.
So anyway, so I was reading that. But I was reading it in between a more important development in my life and the life of my family, which is that my son recently turned 13. And as a mark of his entry into teenagerdom, we bought him a PlayStation 4. Okay, so we have a PlayStation 4 in the house.
Isn't it cool?
He has started... he started playing all the games, right? He's playing Last of Us. He's playing Destiny. He's shooting everything, right? His dad, meanwhile, is also spending hours on the PlayStation watching old arena documentaries.
On
YouTube.
The modern household.
But I've watched a series of the arena documentaries that Nigel Williams, made for BBC Two in the early 80s.
Produced.
A five-part series on George Orwell.
Yeah. Yeah.
An incredible film called A Genius Like Us. About Joe Orton, who lived
just up the road,
minutes walk from where we are now. A fantastic film about Graham Greene, wonderful film with Powell and Pressburger when they were both still alive. And you know what makes these films great? Two things. They are made by people who love and have brilliant working knowledge of the material in question. But also, and the Orton one, I commend everyone, please go and watch this film. Firstly, because it was made not even 15 years after Orton had died. So it is full of people who knew Orton.
Yeah.
But the great thing, the thing that makes these films so great, is they let people talk.
It's amazing.
There are long, 3-4 minute, uninterrupted sections with Leone, Orton's sister, with Charles Monteith, who nearly published Orton, but didn't. There's a brilliant bit with the librarian who caught Orton and Halliwell in Islington Library, defacing library books, where he describes and reads out some of the jacket copy from the books. It's one of the single funniest things I've ever seen. And he knows it's funny, and he's being allowed to have his moment. I know one is inclined to say, oh, things aren't as good as they used to be, and
I don't know where this exists now. I think you can say it.
What was the thing that you read out to me last week that Hugh Weldon said?
It was a wonderful piece about public service broadcasting. We just published Wynne Weldon's really lovely book about his dad, Hugh Weldon, who, amongst other things, he was never Director General, but he set up Monitor, which was the film unit that out of which Arena grew. But it was just what struck us. I mean, the party for the book was amazing because David Attenborough came, and Humphrey Burton came, and Melvin came, and all the sort of BBC grandies. But you suddenly felt that sense that they were trying to do something that I don't think it's not even on the agenda anymore. They were doing things because they thought they were important to do, and that they were providing a record of something.
Yeah.
And that I think the quote was something along the lines, even if you had an idea wasn't enough. It was only became good television if you worked hard and you did, you made something that was, whereas now it's all about...
It was if you followed your interest and you were true to your interest.
It's all now about ideas. Well, that's good. We should do more visual things. I like that.
I'm just making a virtue.
Is it all YouTube? They're all YouTube, the arena films.
They are, although you can also buy stuff from the BBC shop as well.
Are you saying you've not had access to YouTube before you got a PS4?
I've not had the pleasure of watching
sitting in
YouTube
the glass of wine
on the telly
on a laptop. No Apple TV for
Apple
you.
Apple TV
then.
Is your friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, do you know what the connection is between the book that we're about to talk about? Is that I spent ages trying to find the film of The Riddle of the Sands on Amazon Prime.
What Michael York? It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the whole thing, yeah.
I watched that this week. I think we'll come on to it in due course.
We've talked about books enough. Now for some capitalism.
Lloyd,
yes.
Yes.
Riddle of the Sands. Tell us why you wanted to talk about Riddle of the Sands on a Backlisted.
Well, I read Riddle of the Sands at school, as I'm sure a certain number of people of a certain generation who were educated in a certain type of establishment would have done. And I'd forgotten all about it. And my friend Tim Wright, who is a very clever digital writer, writes stuff for online, also writes BBC Radio 4 plays. A few years ago, he did a thing called Taking a Book for a Walk. He took Kidnapped for a walk from the Western Isles to Stirling in the same time frame as the book and being in the same location. And he said to me, I want to do the same thing with Riddle of the Sands, because as anyone who's listened to our podcast about Riddle of the Sands will know, it's curiously specific about dates and locations. So the idea was that we would take this book and we'd take it for a walk. So I had to go and reread it. And so I reread it, I suppose, 2 years ago.
Mm.
And I just thought it was absolutely amazing. I mean, I'd forgotten how, I read it at the same time I was reading Alistair MacLean and Sven Hassel. You know, it was in that kind of, well, but as a book, I thought it was just staggeringly good.
Yeah.
So we've been doing this podcast about the book, going through each day and drinking lots of things and talking about it. And we went to the Kiel Canal last year to do a couple of days on the Kiel Canal to sort of reenact it. And we've got an Unbound project, as John alluded to try and put a new edition of the book out with us basically taking it out for a walk and finding out what these places are like and going on a few sort of
oil-skin covered kind of, the outdoor edition.
Well, one of the things you find when you put this out there is obviously this book is huge with yachties, right? It's absolutely huge with the sailing fraternity.
There's a reason for that.
If you've got a boat, you have probably read Riddle of the Sands. If you put top 10 sailing books into Google,
for sure,
it's at the number one.
And why is that? Why is it so popular?
Well, because there's a lot of sailing.
Yeah, we should say, John,
there's a massive amount of sailing in it. And if you're not a sailor, I'd say it is a challenge to follow some of the I actually found it quite strangely comforting in a way that I didn't really understand what the fuck was going on. allow me that. But it is very, very, very salt kind of imbued. I mean, it is. I think the things that I loved about the book, that not having read it before, I sort of pretended to read it like you do. Had a vague notion of what it was, and I have a vague memory of Michael York in the film.
Yeah.
And also, we'll come on to Erskine Childers in a moment. He's a pretty extraordinary.
Extraordinary story.
Human being in the story. But I hadn't read it, so sort of knuckling down to read it and I'm a big Arthur Ransom fan. I used to love those books. It reminded me a little bit of a kind of grown-up version of We Didn't Mean to Go to Sea, which is one of my favourites of those.
Yeah.
But it is quite complicated, and the plot...
There's a very particular love of... I mean, what I would perceive as quite male as well.
Mm.
Detail. Love of gadgetry and detail, right? That the first 100 pages are largely spent lovingly... describing types of spinnacle. Whatever that... I don't even know what a spinnacle is. What is a spinnacle?
There's no such thing as a spinnacle.
You
just made that word up.
For the part of me that... because we've just moved to these offices and we're on the canal, I've got a serious boat lust at the moment. I dawdle along the canal on the way home, and I kind of look fondly at the little stoves and the engines and the... Mm. And actually, so this sort of hit me in a quite good... Yeah. Moment, receive mode. I've gazed for hours into the windows of Arthur Beale's chandlery.
Neal
Street.
We've had a lot of it. We've done events at Arthur Beale's as a result.
I know. I suppose the thing is that the book is that there are things that are really remarkable about it. I don't think anybody had done this kind of clever frame.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we should talk a little bit about that.
Let's hang on to that for a moment, because I want to ask Lloyd about that. Shall I just do the now traditional...
Blurby blur.
Blurby blur. We've got two... We seem to have two different editions of Riddle of the Sands.
I've got the vintage classics edition.
Right, I'll give you mine first.
Okay.
So there's a pull quote. The first real thriller, Ken Follett.
Not bad.
That's not bad. Erskine would have been happy with that.
Yeah.
While on a duck hunting holiday...
Sorry.
No.
Come on, everyone.
It's already terrible.
While on a duck hunting holiday sailing in the Frisian Isles, Carruthers and his friend Davis, which are you? Lloyd.
Yeah, I am not Davis, so I'm Davis.
You're Davis.
On the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, you're Davis. You are Simon McCorkindale.
I'm Simon McCorkindale. Yeah.
Carruthers,
and his friend,
Carruthers and his friend Davis become suspicious of German naval activity off the North Sea coast.
It's terrible. It's
the awful. Pair decide to investigate and are soon embroiled in a world of suspense and intrigue as they set about foiling nothing less than a plot to invade England. Initially published in 1903, The Riddle of the Sands proved a prescient vision of the Anglo-German conflict that was to culminate in the First World War. This thrilling adventure is now regarded as the first and one of the best spy novels ever written, okay, inspiring later masters of the genre from John Buchan to John le Carré.
Okay, shall I do vintage classics?
Yeah, go on, here we go.
Well, also, careful, there's a plot spoiler in the vintage classics.
Oh. Yeah, hang on. Yes, spoiler alert. Paul quote, a ripping yarn, it's just so exciting, Ben McIntyre. When Carruthers receives a letter from his friend Davis suggesting a Baltic sailing trip, the vision of a manned yacht, A1 scenery and excellent duck shooting quickly works its charm. But Carruthers' hopes for a holiday are quickly dashed. There has been suspicious activity along the coast. The Medusa, manned by the sinister Dolman, has already tried to destroy Davis. What are the Germans up to? Nothing less than a plot to invade Britain. Well, I think we can say that. And only these two courageous Englishmen can stop them. Published in 1903, The Riddle of the Sands is considered the first modern spy novel. And then it says underneath, see also The 39 Steps.
Can I read what John Buchan said about it?
Yes!
It's better than either of those.
Yeah.
John Buchan, I think they are the most truly realised of any adventure story that I have met, and the atmosphere of grey northern skies and miles of yeasty water and wet sands is as masterfully reproduced as in any story of Conrad's.
Oh, that's...
So I'm putting that out there as a much better
play. Yeah. I have to say...
I'm sensing you didn't like it very
much. Well, I think the sighting of ripping yarns in that blurb... See, we just did, as you may be aware, we just did a couple of weeks ago... Bert Fegg's Nasty Book for Boys and Girls by Michael Palin and Terry Jones, which contains the original idea of Across the Andes by Frog, subsequently made into Ripping Yarns. Mm. And I'm not sure I have ever read one of the texts that Palin and Jones are clearly spoofing Ripping Yarns. Yeah. So it took me a little while to settle into the book, because it seemed like a tremendously good setup to a punchline that never came. But I did like it. I struggled a bit, as John did, with the opening section.
Yeah.
Although I loved the... It starts in a brilliant way, this book, with a kind of... That great tradition of the languid hero who's seen everything and done everything and is rather jaded.
The truth is, I was bored.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
A bit of club.
But Lloyd, is that true then, that this is the first spy novel, as we would understand?
Well, no, not really. Kim was published a few years before.
Kipling, yeah.
I think the thing about this book that you... Well, first of all, it's like I suppose it's like reading anything that was... This book was an enormous success when it came out.
Yeah, and
it sold 2 million copies.
Christ.
It's never been out of print in Britain. Churchill arranged for it to be delivered to every ship in the Navy at the beginning of the First World War, which is ironic given what came later. We'll come into that.
it was
of huge significance. But the other interesting thing is that Childers never wanted it to be called a novel. He was violently opposed to it being called a novel. And he didn't want to be called the author. He wanted to be called the editor. So the whole thing was, this is a found text. So the whole shtick was that these guys had actually existed. And even today, you can read stuff in the sailing fraternity where people clearly think this stuff sort of actually happened. And I think a lot of the difficulty, perhaps, with the sailing stuff is Childers himself sailed this route in 1897. On his own boat, so it's all
very vivid in his mind. He's describing what actually happened. Yeah. And obviously, it's all stuff that, you know, he was really interested in. But, you know, Britain at the time was a sailing nation, right? Well, so this, and that's a huge
and we're not theme. Anymore, that's right? A huge theme in the book, the decline of Britain as a sailing nation.
Well, the decline of Britain as a little boat sailing nation.
And of course, with Dunkirk down the road. But that's one of the great... I think some of those rants of Davis in the book about...
Well, Davis is clearly chilled, right? Davis is this sort of, you know, slightly off to the side, disconnected, you know, a little bit, you know, humorless and a little bit sort of, you know, straight back, sort of, but also fiercely patriotic. Well, fiercely everything, you know, fiercely fierce, fiercely in love, fiercely patriotic, fiercely, you know.
Whilst I did struggle a little bit with some of the, like, trying to figure out.
I'm counting the word struggle, so a little tally down here.
Just with the understanding. The sales and what the, you know, I mean,
Spinnaker is a word, isn't it?
And spinnaker is also not in the book. Right. No.
Spinnaker's not in the book.
Trying to back you up there.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that didn't really bother me in the end because I thought that was it's the sort of thing if you read it maybe more slowly and carefully, if you were on a sailing holiday, you were learning how to sail, you'd probably master it quite quickly.
Yeah, so the way he does it is Carruthers doesn't know how to sail.
Yeah.
Right, so Carruthers is learning how to sail in the first quarter of the book, and that's kind of... So you're learning as you go along.
And it's sort of the whole thing. It becomes, actually, after a while, quite mesmerising, and the sense of place is really extraordinary. Yeah. All that tacking in the dark and the...
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... I guess it's just I think the... The thing you say about it being male is kind of true. I mean, it's two men on a boat, and there's quite a lot of technical detail in it. But once you get the beginning of the sense of where the plot is taking you, I mean, it's quite hard. I mean, there is a plot. You know, the spoiler is on the back, but it's quite a long way into the book before you've got any bloody idea that it's about a plot.
Well, I suppose the other thing is...
It's just the dolman and the Medusa are kind of sinister, and he keeps that plausibility of their alternatives. I would also say there is some really lovely writing in the book. I mean, you know, he's very, very good on wind and water and the movement of water. And, I mean, I'm going to just read a little... I'm just going to read a little bit of this, and I'm sure you've got bits you want as well, Lloyd, but this just fell open on this. Later, as the wind sank to lazy airs, he became busy with a large topsail and jib, but I was content to doze away the afternoon, drenching brain and body in the sweet and novel foreign atmosphere, and dreamily watching the fringe of glen, cliff, and cool white sand as they passed ever more slowly by. Mm. Very good of that. Yeah. And the whole thing of Carruthers arriving and not feeling, you know, ghastly, the whole thing is just, he can't believe he's got a portmanteau that's far too big for the boat.
And there's some really good comic business about this fop showing up.
Yeah, shall we go and stay in a hotel? I don't really like going on.
Yeah, where are you? Are your men arriving? There are no men arriving.
It's like the worst, you're sort of beginning with the worst. And then gradually, the boat is quite small and pokey and difficult. There's a lot of good stuff about what it's like sleeping in a bunk.
But I think you're right, Lloyd. I think that's clearly deliberate, isn't it? There's a clear attempt to take the reader by the hand and say...
And put them in a boat.
Yeah, put them in a boat and say...
There's a very funny bit. Can I read that? I'm not going to read the bit I was going to read, because the bit I was going to read is more in line with this. But there's a funny bit about Carruthers arriving, and he goes down into the boat and bangs his head and bangs his shins and all this kind of stuff. You see, were Davis's reassuring words, there's plenty of room to sit upright, which was strictly true, but I'm not very tall, and he is short. Some people make a point of headroom, but I never mind much about it. That's the centreboard case, he explained, as, in stretching my legs out, my knee came into contact with a sharp edge. I had not seen this devilish construction as it was hidden beneath the table, which indeed rested on it at one end. It appeared to be a long, low triangle running lengthways with the boat and dividing the naturally limited space into two. You see, she's a flat-bottomed boat, drawing very little water without the plate. That's why there's so little headroom. For deep water, lower the plate. So in one way or another, you can go practically anywhere. I was not nautical enough to draw any definite conclusions from this. But what I did draw were not promising.
That's great.
There's a lot of that stuff with Carruthers. But also, when Carruthers gets into the sailing, there is some really lovely bits with him kind of going, OK, I'm beginning to understand why people are into this now. And so, you know,
I think that's rather, there's lots of good stuff. But I do think this thing about it not being a novel, right? The thing about
that's what I wanted to say. It's the frame. I think I can't think of a novel that has this completely realised frame that this was found papers and I'm the editor, which he sort of says in the
which
preface.
Is EC,
that, I think, is EC. Which has obviously been used many times since. But
was it? Sorry, when it was published then?
It was published in 1903. I'm just finding the but it was called The Rid of the Sand, a record of Secret Service recently achieved.
Yeah.
And what was the author like?
Edited by Erskine Childers.
What was the author like?
What
was Erskine like?
Well,
I've got 11 pages that I can go through.
Matthew, if I give you the title of some of Erskine's other books, this was the only novel that he wrote, and he didn't want it to be seen as
only novel he wrote.
And his other books include War and the Arme Blanche, German Influence on British Cavalry, The Framework for Home Rule.
Yeah.
You know, he was a serious mofo.
So he was born 1870, born to an English father and an Irish mother. That will become important in Mayfair. And his father died when he was 8 years old, and there was some strange family business that involved his mother going to a sanatorium. And he was basically adopted by his Irish aunt and uncle and went to live in Ireland. Then sent to school in England, aged 11 or whatever, and educated in England, different times. And the Irish family were members of the Ascendancy, the Protestant Irish Ascendancy, who'd basically been running the place for 700 years. So he goes to private school, goes to Trinity, then goes into the civil service, becomes a House of Commons clerk in about 1890, whatever. Gets into sailing, mid-1890s, buys a boat, goes sailing, then goes, joins up for the Boer War, and then comes back and writes The Rid of the Sands. And the point of The Rid of the Sands was it fell into this category of invasion literature.
And is it his first book?
It's his first book. He wrote a book of his letters from the Boer War were published before then.
Yeah.
I can't remember the title of the book, but it's letters from the Boer War. And so there's a whole category of books about the invasion, growing threat of Germany, including the magnificently named The Battle for Dorking, which came out in 1871. But there's a whole range of books about Britain being invaded. So he puts it, and this is by far the most influential. And actually causes the Admiralty to go, oh, hang on a minute, we need to build some boats.
There's a bit at the end of the vintage edition, or I think it was, where they did make some changes.
They did make some changes.
It was the beginning of the
dreadnought arms race and, you know, building more and more dreadnoughts. So the book comes out, it's hugely successful, makes his name. He marries a Bostonian woman and, you know, works as a clerk, but then gets him increasingly interested in the Irish question. We will begin to tread carefully as we go through this, but he gets increasingly into the Irish question for Irish home rule. His wife is quite a Republican, you know, she's American, and she thinks that the British Empire is probably not the greatest thing since sliced bread as Erskine had thought it was. Gets more and more interested in home rule, and fights in the First World War, has a real ripping yarns First World War, actually, you know, flying planes and navigating, and actually Churchill being a big fan of Rid of the Sands, Churchill had proposed an invasion of the East Frisian Islands based on Rid of the Sands, which was abandoned and replaced with an invasion of Gallipoli. So, Childers was the navigator for Gallipoli. He was up in the plane.
It's worth saying one of the amazing things about this book is with the charts and the descriptions in this book, you could actually invade the East Frisian Islands. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
It's also worth saying about Childers, and you'll know why I say this now.
Yeah.
You were talking about Churchill. In this period, Churchill described Childers as, quote, a great patriot and statesman.
Yes.
We'll come back to that.
And so Childers is right in the centre of this, you know, of England and empire and all this kind of stuff. Comes back from the First World War and basically moves to Ireland and basically becomes a proponent of Irish Home Rule. Goes to the Paris Convention.
He's a liberal to begin with, wasn't he?
He's moved from liberal.
Yeah.
When the liberals sort of messed up home rule or compromised it, he became more and more. And then ends up being on the convention in 1922, on the other side of the table from Churchill, Austin Chamberlain, Lloyd George, arguing for Irish home rule. That leads to the creation of the Irish Free State in 1922, Childers is violently opposed to the Irish Free State because he thinks it's a compromise, because it's not actually an independent republic, it's a dominion within the empire.
Because of the treaty.
Because of the treaty. De Valera, Eamon de Valera, is also violently opposed to it. The two of them go into hiding, basically, in the Southern Ireland. Michael Collins, Arthur Griffith, all the Sinn Féin people are in favour of it, and they sign the treaty. Arthur Griffiths violently falls out with Erskine Childers because everyone is saying, who is this English guy and why is he talking for Ireland?
Yeah.
And then the rumour starts going around that he's actually a spy. Right. He's actually a spy for the English.
Which I guess, with the sounds, might lead you to believe it's not impossible.
And then in 1922, he's in hiding and he's arrested by the Irish Free State Army.
Has he been gun running?
Well, the gun running story is. I'll talk about the gun running story separately.
All right, right.
But the Irish Free State arrest him, and he is shot by the Irish Free State in 1922.
Firing squad.
By a firing squad.
But they arrest him because.
But he's carrying a gun that was given to him by Michael Collins.
Collins, yeah.
And that's illegal. It's illegal to carry.
But it's a pretext for shooting this guy. And the reason he's shot is that he's the guy. He is the guy who's saying, you've surrendered to the English. Mm. You've surrendered to the English. You've messed it up. Ulster's gone its own way. You've messed it up. Why did you do this? Why did you? And he's gone. And he's very. There's a lot of George Orwell about Erskine Childers because he's the very austere kind of, you know, librarian figure going, you've messed it all up. You messed it all up. So they shoot him. Basically, they kill him. Postscript, 1971. His son, Erskine Hamilton Childers, becomes president of the Irish Republic. So it's an amazing life story.
He also has. He also has two other things worth noting. That Churchill, who, I mean, something like 5 years. It's not much more than that. Who 5 years earlier had referred to him as a great patriot and statesman. When the death sentence was passed on Childers, he said the following thing. Churchill said, "No man has done more harm, or done more genuine malice, or endeavoured to bring a greater curse upon the common people of Ireland than this strange being, actuated by a deadly and malignant hatred for the land of his birth." That's quite a swing, isn't it? And also, there's this amazing story, actually, very stirring story, about Childers's conduct in front of the firing squad. Do you want to
tell us that? He goes up to every member of the firing squad and shakes their hand, goes back to stand there, and he goes, "Take a step forward, lad, it'll be easier." Wow. It's a great story. And his final words to his wife. Right, she writes just as he's going to that. "Now I am going, coming to you, heart's beloved, sweetheart, comrade, wife. I shall fall asleep in your arms. God above blessing us, all four of us, Erskine." It's good stuff. It's boy's own stuff, and it's still controversial to this day. His role in Irish independence, you know, this Englishman at the heart of this basically struggle with England.
Well, there does seem to be that element in the novel of him. A number of times his attraction to the idea is what he calls romance, which is, you know, that getting carried away with the sort of the story and the transformation of Carruthers, who is a kind of, you know, as you say, languid sort of policy wonky Foreign Office bod, you know, going to his club smoking cigars and you know, living a life of pampered ease.
Not particularly engaged.
And then, you know, becoming suddenly, by the end of the novel, he's kind of doing all kinds of heroic stuff in boats and shaving off his moustache and pretending and dressing in disguise.
I think one of the interesting things about that stuff is a lot of the stuff that we now take for granted, it's kind of spy books, is kind of all there.
Yeah.
There's the disguise stuff, there's the fantastic dinner party near the end, where no one is saying quite what they mean,
it's a brilliant bit of writing, I think.
And the brilliant bit where he's creeping through the fog to listen outside the building.
All that stuff. So the second half, there's very little sailing in the second half of the book. Listeners,
I wouldn't want to put people off. I don't think the sailing is a kind of it's not a deal breaker.
Well, one of the reasons we were doing
we wanted to take it away
from the sailors a little bit, because
the
minute you say, "Oh, we're reenacting the Riddle of the Sands," sailing world are on the phone going, "What boat are you going in?" Right? And we're like, "Well, we don't sail. We're sticking on the land. We're more interested in the, you know, the culture, the drink, the food,
which is beautifully. I mean, you do have that very strong sense of that very weird, that Frisian coast. It sort of does make you want to go visit it.
It's funny saying it's the first thriller. one thinks of a thriller now.
Mm.
Like, if I think of a thriller, I think a thriller might be Lee Child. Mm. Right? And Lee Child, great though Lee Child is, doesn't hang about.
No.
Like, page three, you're off.
Yeah.
Right? What I found fascinating about this book is there's a very deliberate, it seemed to me, hang on in there, hang on in there, hang on in there. Once we're underway, then we'll really go for it.
Well, I think a lot of that is actually from the sailing, because if you've ever sailed, yeah, you do, there is quite a lot of hanging on
hanging around.
There.
Yeah,
you're not
the
going very fast.
There's a lot of waiting for the wind.
There's a lot of waiting for the wind and all that kind of stuff. But also, you're into music from the 60s and 70s, and one of the fascinating things about that is they're making it up, right? They're making up what we now take as being.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
and this is what this book is doing. It's like all the stuff at the beginning in London when he's going out and buying all this stuff.
Which I love.
It's just like
the
Bond.
The Ripping Gale stoves.
It's just like Bond visiting Q and going, buy this, take that, buy that. And Fleming does it in 3 pages, and Childers does it in 20. But, you know, we haven't
got it's a sort of. I mean, you know, it's not unfamiliar. I mean, in a way, if you're. Rider Haggard, which is considerably harder to read than Erskine Childers, and even John Buchan, who I kind of I guess kind of probably was inspired by this. I'm thinking.
Well, they're right. They're right at the same time. Buchan was a very very big fan of Childers.
Yeah, but I mean, I what I liked was the idea that you would you're referred in the text to the maps and charts. I mean, it was an attempt to really. To realise something that was happening in the real world, you know, there was no, it wasn't just imagination. But at the same time, you know, the delaying, I think, is because it is a riddle. I mean, it is looking at trying to figure out what motives are, and it's boats in the night, and it's kind of, you know, who's that coming towards us now? It's the girl who you kind of figure that Davis has got the hots for, but it's not never quite clear. I mean, it's lots of
a little bit more than the hots. I mean, he's in a complete state.
He's in an absolute funk.
Lloyd, has anybody ever made a musical of the
No, there's been a film.
There has been a film. That's right. We've been talking about the amazing sophistication of this book and the way it plugs into the geopolitical scene of the time. Let's just listen to the trailer from the 1979 film.
What started as a harmless holiday ended in a desperate struggle for their lives.
Peter Skinneramas.
Michael York, Simon McCorkindale in the classic spy thriller, The Riddle of the Sands.
Now playing in its sixth MASH week, call the Satori hotline, 563-6102.
So, and is that film... I watched the film this week. I quite enjoyed it.
I think the film's pretty good. It's Michael York as Carruthers.
Yeah.
A stunning Carruthers.
I love Michael
York. And Simon McCorkindale, I think, is a pretty good Davis.
A.K.A.
You know, Ernest.
A.K.A. Manimal.
A Manimal, yeah.
Jenny Agutter.
Jenny Agutter as Clara Dolman.
And Mr. Bronson from Grange
Mr.
Hill.
Mr. Bronson as
Michael Sheard.
Well,
as Burma. As Burma.
So, Matthew Clayton. Do you have any tenuous links to this book?
Yeah, it's a tenuous link. I've got a tenuous link. I'm going to ask Andy, what the tenuous link is between Carruthers and Phileas Fogg.
Is it David Niven? your nemesis, David Niven.
Let that drop.
Yeah. is it Michael York?
No, it's not Michael York. It's Bradshaw's. Bradshaw's Continental.
Very good.
So Bradshaw's Continental is the travel guide, kind of incredible travel guide published by.
It is amazing.
It's a railway timetable.
Yeah, but it's kind of railway.
It's also got steamers and hotels
and everything you need to know.
So it features in Phileas Fogg, but it also Bradshaw's also feature in Sherlock Holmes, Count Dracula, G.K. Chesterton, Lewis Carroll, and Agatha Christie, which is really incredible. But my favourite Bradshaw story. Is the one that connects Bradshaw's with Michael Portillo. So...
Oh, he's got coin.
So wonderfully. I mean, this is a wonderful story. So in 2010, Michael Portillo starts a TV series, Great British Train Journeys, where he follows the Bradshaw's British guide, around railway journeys of Britain. And in January 2012, an extraordinary thing happens. which is the facsimile version of the 1863 Bradshaw's book, sells 30,000 copies. Old House of the Publishers, part of Osprey, and it goes on to sell over 100,000 copies, the facsimile edition of his 19th century train guide, because of Michael Portillo's program. Isn't that insane?
Very fantastic.
This is what every editor dreams of happening.
It's out of copyright.
Totally, yeah. It's out of copyright.
It's got no colour in it.
It's no colour.
We aren't going to have to be paying Bradshaw. Yeah.
There's no author.
There's no author, and it's totally random. Completely random, out of nowhere.
Yeah. When did Bradshaw... Do we know when they stopped making Bradshaws?
Well, Bradshaw died in 1853, but they carried on after his death.
I've got an 1896... facts online, I download it off the internet. Right. It's basically like downloading the internet.
It's basically the Victorian internet.
25 gigs.
There are over 1,000.
That's what I did to the BBC food section the other day. I've downloaded them all. If anyone needs a copy,
recipe cards, Matt.
Recipe cards, recipe.
But I love
laminated.
That Bradshaw's is in there. I love that. Yeah. And it featured so much in the literature of the time.
But the funny thing about Bradshaw's in this book, because obviously, Childers, when he did his sailing trip, he didn't take a train. He did everything on the water.
Yeah.
So to research the train bits, there's quite an involved train section, if you remember. He's got to be at a certain place at a certain time, and they're going to disguise in the toilet and come out. Yeah. You know. And actually, he must have researched all that in Bradshaw's. Because actually, the times in Bradshaw's are identical to the times in the book. So you kind of go, well, actually, he's just opened his Bradshaw's in when he was researching the book, just as I do when I've got to go to St. Helena and just read it out.
There's a quote there, isn't there, about a man starts going back to and looking through his Bradshaw's in the same way that he will fondle his gun in the office.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, Lloyd, why Childers only...
Yeah.
Why didn't Childers not write more novels?
Yeah.
But actually, I wonder if the question is not that, but why he wrote a novel in the first place.
Well, I think because the interesting thing about his writing, the thing that he was involved in Ireland, people said that the reason the English government caved in sort of 1920, 1921 to the Irish was partly Michael Collins' guerrilla warfare, but equally Erskine Childers' propaganda, because all he was doing all day long, he was running the Irish Bulletin, which was the Sinn Féin newspaper. He was editing it and basically writing it all day long. So I think he probably thought that novels were somewhat frivolous. And actually, one of the interesting things about being a writer, you look at the life of Erskine Childers. I mean, this is a man who was violently in the world. Right? He was trying to change the world, and the thing he tried to change the world with was his writing. So you mentioned his stuff on his pamphlets on the British Army, the cavalry. Yeah. You know, they were hugely influential, because he was basically saying, we're about to go to war and we've still got men on horses carrying swords. Do you have any idea how bad this is going to be? And so he was that's why Churchill was such a huge fan of his, because he was saying all that. So I think he probably found an outlet for his writing that was to do with changing the world. He probably, he probably couldn't think of another novel that would have the same effect.
His conversion to the cause of Irish nationalism is quite an extreme thing.
You can see why people were suspicious, because it's so extreme. It's so...
Well, look at your CV. Spy novel. Okay.
You know what? Thanks for choosing this, Lloyd. I learned so much. And not just about spinnacles, everyone. I learned so much about... I think I thought Riddle of the Sands was some kind of Egyptian thing. Right?
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about the novel. But actually learning about Childers... Yeah, Riddle of the
Sands. Surprising that he's not better known, I think, in England particularly.
It was almost surprising. Presumably the book was already so successful that it couldn't then be suppressed after he'd been shot... for some kind of treachery.
There's a lovely moment when they're negotiating in London and he's basically been kicked out of the room because the Irish are so sick of him being so sort of intransigent. And there's a bit in his letters back to Molly, his wife, where he says, spent the time discussing the Riddle of the Sands with the guy, with the man outside. He was a big fan. So, all this stuff's going on. He's got Lloyd George, Winston Churchill in the room with Oxford Chamberlain and Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins in the room there. And he's chatting about it. And what he's known for is the Riddle of the Sands. That's amazing.
It is also about German militarism, was another thing. It's quite prescient about the fact that the Germans are
and quite admiring of the sort of the organisation.
Well, the hard thing to read in the book, I think, you know, is the imperial side of it, the idea that actually empire is great and Germany needs an empire as much as England does, and you know, why would they not have one? They deserve one. And so, you know, that kind of thing is politically quite hard for us to read now. But it was perfectly, you know, absolutely standard liberal policy in 1903.
I think that's probably as good a point as any to stop. Thank you to Lloyd Shepherd, to Matthew, of course, as always, to producer Matt Hall, and once again, thanks to Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at @BacklistedPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/BacklistedPod, and on our page at the Unbound website, which is unbound.co.uk/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again in a fortnight.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.